Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And today we are joined by the fabulous Mika Yo-Yang.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what we're drinking.
We are drinking French 75s, named after the World War I French guns, which is champagne, gin, sugar cube, and a little lemon. And the champagne is courtesy of my lovely former national security fellow, Gary Ashcroft, who, as a Mormon, doesn't drink, so he brought me the alcohol that other people gave to him.
Handy.
Handy. Plug for Gary. If you're looking for a really great national security fellow in national security law, Gary is available on the market.
And he brings booze.
Exactly.
We love it. We should all have somebody who brings us the booze that they can't drink. I don't know why I haven't thought about that in job position descriptions previously, but I'm going to...
I think that certain agencies are already on to that.
We actually have a... no alcohol policy, like anywhere in the office at my work.
I'm sorry, are you kidding?
It's disappointing, to say the least.
Whereas people, if you come by my office, there's like strange liquor bottles littered all over the place. I definitely look
Your office is like a weird clean out the liquor cabinet party.
Yeah, more or less.
It's like, what can we do with chartreuse, rum, and this leftover Kahlua?
Amazing things.
amazing things. So Mika's had a very interesting career in national security. She started at The Hill and is now at Third Way.
That's correct.
And tell us what you do there.
I run the national security program there. And Third Way's national security program focuses on two big things. One is Congress's role in national security, which a lot of people don't think of because it's largely an executive branch function. And the other thing that we focus a lot on is the politics of national security.
Excellent. We're going to talk a little bit about, I think, polling and some of those politics here in a second. But first, shall we do the bombshell questions, Lauren?
We shall. The questions that we ask all of our guests. First, what is the best meal that you have ever eaten while traveling?
So the best meal that I've ever eaten while traveling, and I tend to travel to eat, so there are a lot of them. But the best one was a dinner that I had in Istanbul at this restaurant, Chia Sofrazi, for another national security person's wedding. And if you haven't read Elif Batuman's article in The New Yorker about this restaurant, it is fantastic. The chef there has gone back and recreated old Turkish dishes and gone back and found ingredients that were lost and makes these just really amazing Turkish food. It's on the Asia side.
Very
highly
cool.
Recommend.
Amazing. What is the book that you have either reread the most or owned the longest?
So reread the most would be The Princess Bride, which
really
is which I read before I saw the movie and is a fantastic book.
It is actually a very good book. And it's just as whimsical as the movie, but it's richer and different. And you sort of, there are such iconic characters from the movie, but they aren't all written quite that way because there's kind of interesting performances. That's interesting.
Exactly. And there's a lot more backstory about the politics of that particular
Gilder
and the other countries. And they're like these long discursions on fashion and wigs and things that are sort of absurd and wonderful.
Utterly wonderful.
What is the fan club or fan community that you've been a part of in your life?
So I'm not really a fan club person, but early on in life, like many young women of my age, I was a big fan of Duran Duran.
I can see this. Do you own a ripped t-shirt of Duran Duran or anything like that?
Did you have Tiger Beat posters?
I did have a poster of Simon Le Bon, mm-hmm. But I did not have any ripped t-shirts because with overprotective Asian parents, I have never been to a Duran Duran concert.
Oh, wow.
That would be a good question. What was the first concert you ever went to?
Oh, yeah.
Think about that.
Rage Against the Machine.
Michael Jackson.
You guys are way cooler
nice.
Than I am.
Well, that's how we select our guests. We try to find like, the handful of folks that can make us feel cool.
You are the Twitter crush of many, but who is the Twitter or Facebook crush that you have right now? Somebody that you follow but don't necessarily know and are kind of obsessed with.
So I am kind of obsessed with @PwnAllTheThings on Twitter.
Same.
Yes.
Really fascinating. I'm told British, love a British accent, have never met him in person, but would
Quinta
really
offered.
Like to.
Yeah. He was here in town a couple weeks ago.
Very disappointing. Mysterious.
Well, maybe you want to keep it that way.
Maybe. Don't want to spoil a mystery.
That's right.
Also, he knows a lot about U.S. national security mm-hmm. issues for a Brit in a way that is semi-amazing / disturbing.
Also gives really good security advice.
Nice.
What is your favorite museum?
So I was just talking about this with my mom over Thanksgiving. It's the British Museum.
Oh, the Museum of Shit We Stole.
Exactly.
It's a good one.
Yeah. And
they don't even try to hide it.
No, they don't. Like my mom took me there as a child and she was just remarking on how I was sort of obsessed with the Elgin marbles, also the Rosetta Stone.
Have I told you guys my situation with the Elgin marbles?
No.
You have a situation?
Well, I thought they were like marbles.
Oh, God.
Like shooting marbles.
Like, but how long did you think this?
Till I went there again last summer.
Oh, my God. Wow.
So a Harvard PhD will do lots of things for you, but it won't teach you that the Elgin marbles are in fact giant statues. Sometimes it's weird to grow up in Kansas. I don't know.
What is the best geek field trip you have ever been on?
So over inauguration, I was in Oslo on this really fantastic Atlantic Council trip, which I highly recommend everyone try to get on because it's amazing. We had a free afternoon, and so I dragged a bunch of people, including Aaron Mehta of Defense News, to see the Norwegian Resistance Museum, which is amazing. And it's the whole story of the Nazi occupation of Norway, and I did not realize the Nazis took Norway in less than 12 hours.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a Quisling government. It's like what it means to be a Quisling.
Exactly.
Like, you just give up.
There's this whole history and then the resistance. And it was just, as a national security nerd, it was super amazing.
It's part of why Occupied is so cool. Definitely all waiting on Occupied season 2, in case anybody's wondering. But yes.
Aaron, you can ask the last question.
All right, Mika. What is your favorite statistical distribution?
This one was very difficult because, despite being Asian, I'm not particularly good at math. But I would have to say that my favorite statistical distribution is exponential.
Lovely.
And that's in part because, you know, you have these, most things are fine, and then you get out to the extremes and things can go very rarely horribly awry or horribly wonderful. And it is also, in the reverse, the same as the enrichment curve for weaponized uranium.
Good answer.
Wow.
Well done.
That's one of the best answers I've heard of from a person who admittedly does not like math.
Yeah.
Impressive all around, Mika.
Thanks.
Excellent. Okay. Shall we queue up some foreign relations?
Let's do it. Speed lightning round.
We are going to do like a speed round because there's just a lot and we don't have in-depth commentary on any of these issues in particular, but feel like you, our listeners, should know some things. So first up, Zimbabwe.
So basically, Robert Mugabe resigned as president. He stepped down. He had been
not
in power.
The first time he thought we thought he was going to resign, but
right.
Like 24, 48 hours later.
He is, so far as we understand, he actually did resign. He's been in power since 1980. The likely successor to him is his former vice president, who he fired a couple of weeks ago, known colloquially as the crocodile. So for anybody who's thinking that this means peace and joy and hope for the future of Zimbabwe, I mean, I guess it could be worse, but the crocodile does not give me a ton of warm and fuzzies. Maybe better than like a long-term strongman who's been ruling since 1980, but also possibly somebody with a lot of human rights abuses and not the greatest record.
Probably was responsible for the result of like 20-some thousand civilian deaths in an operation in the 1990s. So,
though I will say, Zimbabwe sort of had a choice between the crocodile or having another Eva Peron situation, since the other potential successor was Mugabe's wife, Grace.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. So that's is a period of political transition for Zimbabwe. And I think for a lot of folks in kind of, I don't know, mainstream national security, it tends not to draw a lot of focus. But for folks who do African politics and do African security, Zimbabwe is actually a pretty critical piece of southern Africa, both because of its political history, but also because Mugabe had been there for so long. So I know that there are lots of folks in the government who kind of watch these transitions pretty carefully. Next up, speaking of political transitions, Germany.
So like a few days ago, there were headlines saying that like Germany is falling apart. The political winds are saying there's a hurricane.
Worst political crisis since World War II.
Awful, awful. But actually, maybe not that bad.
Maybe not that bad. So it looks like we're going to get a grand coalition in Germany. I was super confused about tweets I saw last week or the week before from like Tom Wright and Julie Smith about the Jamaica coalition falling apart.
Yes, the colors.
And I was like, why did they care about Jamaican politics all of a sudden? That actually was about the colors in the German coalition between the CDU, the FDP, and the Greens. That's what fell apart. So now it looks like we're going to go back potentially to a grand coalition between the left and right wing parties in Germany, the CDU and the SPD, the socialists. It takes a great deal of effort for me not to say those initials with my high school German accent, which is the only place I ever had to say them out loud for the most part. So, but that it looks like there will be a grand coalition. Merkel does not want to do a minority government.
And quickly, why this matters is basically that within Europe, they have a lot of shit to do in terms of any number of EU reforms and other negotiations that they have with a variety of countries within that. You may have heard of them, like Brexit, so on and so forth. So having this coalition in place would give a little more stability to Merkel's leadership of the, you know, the political world in the EU.
And certainly nobody is looking for Merkel to leave anytime soon. That would be deeply destabilizing to a whole bunch of diplomatic endeavors.
I do keep looking at her and thinking, when does a woman get to retire?
She should go to a nice spa somewhere.
No, she's like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She can never go.
Next up, North Korean defector.
Okay, so very briefly, if you have not seen the video of the North Korean defector escaping across the DMZ, it is like the best action movie, but real, you've ever seen before in your life. This guy like is running. There's bullets flying at him. He's being shot. He's in a Jeep. It hits a ditch. He jumps out. There's soldiers like inches away from him trying to grab him. He manages to get across and be saved by the South Koreans.
I saw one report that was like, there were 40 shots fired, five of which hit him. It made me think, war with North Korea might not be that bad.
But apparently the worst thing that actually happened to him was the absolutely horrifying looking parasites that are in his body right now.
Yeah,
never mind, he's been shot five times.
There's all kinds of military intelligence being gleaned from this poor man's guts at this point. So there's like raw corn, which suggests that he's not getting good rations, and maybe other soldiers also aren't as well. And that's revealing. It's sort of this bizarre reading of tea leaves that we do for these very, very closed societies. We don't have a lot of opportunities to figure out what's actually going on there.
And this is the first time in a while, I think, that anyone's crossed the DMZ successfully.
That's right.
Right? Most people who defect come through other places.
That's right. I mean, they tend to go through China, or they tend to come through by sea. There are a surprising number of North Korean defectors, but they tend not to be North Korean army soldiers who come across the DMZ directly. Yes. Okay. What's next on our, we need like a wheel to spin, I feel like, for our lightning round. Saudi Arabia.
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot going on in Saudi Arabia, as you remember from our last few episodes, but Tom Friedman, thank God, has gone to the region to catch us all up on the fact that Saudi Arabia's Arab Spring is here at last. Even though it's winter, even though Arab Spring isn't maybe like the most positive terminology to associate with anything in the region ever again. Even though Prince Mohammed bin Salman just locked up all of the gazillionaires and his uncles and is maybe not the nicest guy on the planet, but Thomas Friedman has once again assured us, based on his taxi driver intelligence, that all is well in Riyadh.
So this is the thing that I don't understand about the taxi driver intelligence, right? Because aren't the reforms supposed to put a lot of these drivers out of business by allowing women to drive? Mixed bag, Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia.
No one really knows what's going on.
Okay.
But didn't he declare that he was the most important millennial, most dangerous millennial, most influential millennial?
He did not. At BuzzFeed, greatest source for news, has declared that MBS is the most powerful millennial alive. Which, like, do you want powerful millennials running anything right now? I am barely a millennial. I should not be running a kingdom, much less like my office.
I don't know. That's a toss up on a lot of things. I feel like we could probably turn that into a debate. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, so when last we met, we were following the dynasty, Falcon Crest Dallas soap opera of the Prime Minister of Lebanon running away to Saudi Arabia. He has now returned to Lebanon.
Right. He didn't actually resign.
And maybe hasn't resigned. But there's, to the extent that there was ever some method to the madness of what went on behind this Hariri resignation, it was to weaken Hezbollah and to basically collapse the existing government in Lebanon. And I don't know if they wanted to call new elections, but they wanted to get these Hezbollah ministers out of the government.
Or maybe he just really needed a sick day.
I mean, some people need them, even the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Well, either way, that's not what has happened. And it seems like Hezbollah has come out
swinging
and is certainly the Hariri branch of the government is not looking super, super great. So there will be continued machinations, I would think, both between Lebanon and Saudi, but then, of course, between this Iran axis that runs through Syria and on into Lebanon. Mika, you had some observations on the Pope's visit Burma.
So Pope Francis going to Burma, trying to talk to Aung San Suu Kyi, moral leader to moral leader, about the ethnic cleansing happening of the Rohingya in Myanmar. Burma? What are we calling it these days?
Well, I think that probably depends a little bit. I don't know. But there was some debate. I mean, there was actually some pressure on the Pope to not talk about the Rohingya at all, right?
That's right. And I think that there are people who are concerned that the shakiness of the civilian government, of Aung San Suu Kyi's government, is really fragile and that she's not in a position to put more pressure on the military, while other people are saying she's really abdicating any claim to moral leadership that she has by not speaking out more forcefully in the situation.
And we also had some discussion on the U.S. side. We had a statement from Tillerson over the weekend. Is that right?
That's right. Tillerson, I can't remember if it was late last week or over the weekend, actually called the situation there an ethnic cleansing, which actually is a fairly strong statement from the U.S. And they were focusing on some of the human rights violations, which is surprising coming out of this administration, given the lack of human rights concerns that they've made in other places.
Although maybe consistent with sort of some of Nikki Haley's statements. I mean, it's sort of part of that axis of commentary. Have we any other foreign relations to keep up? Turkey is like all up in people's business.
Turkey after Thanksgiving.
Oh.
It's like a dad joke, but different. So they are snuggling up to the Russians?
That's right. The Turks have been out for bid on a missile defense system for a long time. Turkey, a NATO ally, has declined now twice to buy a U.S. missile defense system, the Patriot system, even though it's been in bid a couple times. First, they went with the Chinese, got a lot of flack for that. It was a couple years ago. Then canceled that contract and now are flirting with the Russians about buying one of their systems. Part of the ongoing difficulties
that would be
that we
weird
have.
For a NATO ally, right?
That is correct. Yes. So, you know, Turkey not exactly playing the way you want a NATO ally to play.
And I guess, I mean, so Turkey keeps coming up in the news, but in very odd quarters. And maybe this is our segue into White House mayhem.
Oh, yes.
What's the deal with Turkey and Mike Flynn on this front?
So, learned today that Mike Flynn's lawyers are speaking to the Mueller special counsel team, and there's some speculation that it may be seeking a plea agreement. Now, remember, Mike Flynn had been lobbying on behalf of the Turks and failed to register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, including in a wonderful scoop by Shane Harris at the Wall Street Journal, a story suggesting that they had perhaps a conspiracy to kidnap Fethullah Gulen from the U.S. and send him to Turkey, which is a fairly serious charge.
Not a normal transition activity, I'll just say that.
And would certainly give the special counsel at least leverage to make some sort of deal.
Right. And this is just beyond the failure to register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, but a whole series of other things, including a number of members of Congress very concerned about Flynn's failure to disclose some of these contracts, not this, but also a Middle East deal potentially with the Russians to sell advanced nuclear energy technology, which were not disclosed as part of his security clearance process.
Man, there's a lot going on with that, I feel like. And
yeah.
Who was advising this esteemed
general
officer?
As we were saying earlier, it may be that general officers just need a friend. They need a minder when they leave.
We should have like a general officer phone a friend service.
With like maybe with a pocket constitution and
a lawyer on call.
Like Seth Gorka is free these days, I hear.
He has a pocket constitution, as we saw. Never been in a pocket, but looks like it could do the trick. Anything else on Turkey and the machinations of Mike Flynn?
Yeah, I mean, last thing on Turkey, unrelated to Mike Flynn, is that we learned from, I believe, the readout of a phone call between the president and Erdogan over the weekend, that the president supposedly said in this phone call that the United States would no longer be giving weapons to the Syrian Kurds.
Oh, right.
Which was kind of a surprise, I think, maybe also to people in the United States government. I guess we'll find out more about that later. The Turks have kind of doubled down saying, yeah, absolutely. The president, we fully expect the president to follow through on that pledge. This is the sort of thing where in prior governments, you would have seen the United States also issue a statement saying, here's what they talked about. Here's what they committed, X, Y, Z. We don't really do that anymore. So that always gives the recipient caller or the recipient of the presidential call the upper hand in saying, here's what actually the president said and here's what we're going to do about it. So even if we have to correct it later on, we've now created a new cycle for ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine DOD or CENTCOM being super thrilled about that. They love arming some Kurds.
We do it all the time. And
who
it's a
doesn't
real,
love curds?
I mean, it's a real strategic victory for the Russians.
Exactly. Because that's the effective fighting force in Syria.
Exactly.
So that's
speaking of Syria.
Yes.
Speaking of Syria.
How many troops do we have in Syria, Lauren?
Well, I mean, according to the Department of Defense, we have 500.
That's this week. Actually, that was a month ago.
That was also, I kind of feel like it's just sort of a swag. Like, yeah, we have 500-ish or so, even though there has been extensive reporting based on DoD sources that actually we have closer to a lot more than that, maybe a couple thousand.
Yeah, I was, Mike Azenko was tweeting about this and certainly was all Twitter. That joke never gets old.
Wow.
That not just do we have 1,500 more troops in Syria than previously disclosed, but that overall we have, from 4 or 5 months ago, we've gone from 40,000 U.S. troops and DoD civilians in the Middle East to 54,000 troops, that which would be, you know, like a third again as many as previously disclosed. And so on the one hand, maybe that's like some accounting shifts in what we're actually, you know, calling permanently assigned versus just TDY. And there's kind of lots of ways to mask these numbers. But that's a lot of troops. And that doesn't include the Afghan increase.
The other end of this story is the fact that now that we've made significant progress against ISIS in Syria is that the United States may be looking for a long-term open-ended presence of the military in Syria these days of around, the rumor is, 2,000 troops. So, I mean, the question kind of remains, to do what?
For to do what?
What is our Syria strategy? This is something, you know, the president made a nice little speech about our Afghanistan strategy in August that didn't really say a whole hell of a lot. Syria strategy, we still to this day know basically nothing except for the fact that we're going to go kill some terrorists, which, you know, that works really well.
So speaking of that, I don't know if you guys saw this story or heard the podcasts related to the New York Times story on civilian casualties in Iraq in particular.
Oh, do you mean did I sob in my car for 2 days in a row?
Yeah.
Yes.
It was,
I did.
So this was profiled on The Daily. And if folks haven't gone back and listened to those episodes, we'll put them in the show notes for this because they really are quite extraordinary. It did a two-part bit on this story. One bit of which is this very specific story of a man named Bassam and the plight of his particular family. But more broadly is this kind of going back through and trying to figure out basically whether the official tallies of civilian casualties match what happened on the ground. And so the Times reporters, who included Anand Gopal, who wrote a brilliant book on Afghanistan, by the way, concluded that 1 in 5 attacks had civilian casualties, which was like 30 times the official incidence rate that had been disclosed previously, and also that no condolence payments had gone out since 2014. And so for folks who had experience in Iraq or Afghanistan, who worked, whether they were specifically worked civilian casualty issues, which was a big deal, certainly when I was in Afghanistan, but in multiple theaters, to not have any condolence payments go out for 3 years is a real, I don't know if it's a quote unquote shift in policy, but it's a shift in practice, right? And that obviously would go back to the Obama administration as well. And so one of the things that just struck me listening to the podcast in particular about how this man's house was bombed by American drones. And they, at one point, CENTCOM had actually posted the YouTube footage, you know, of this. It was sort of unmistakably an American drone attack. Was that the surveillance of the compound had been done over a few days, but for no more than like an hour total. Like it was like kind of like 15-minute increments.
And done, as he tells so eloquently, during the middle of the day in the summer, it was incredibly hot, so that his children aren't outside, he's not outside, his family's not outside, so the kind of activity you might associate with a family living there was not obvious. But if you'd gone back a few hours later, in his own words, you would have seen evidence that, like, this is a family living here, this isn't an ISIS compound.
And what to me was so heartbreaking about that was that those were things that people knew 5 and 7 years ago. I mean, they understood more about the pattern of life. They understood more about the cultural implications of the intelligence that they were gathering and weren't just, I don't know, making easy mistakes. I don't want to overplay the errors that I think were made on the intelligence side, but there was a point where we had learned not to make that error. And to have unlearned that, to me, was just particularly heartbreaking as somebody who had focused on a lot of these issues for a long time. And gets to some much bigger questions about how you run a large-scale air war without a lot of troops on the ground, without a lot of focus on detailed, nuanced intelligence. And I asked some friends in the Army once, you know, why did we fix these problems at one point and why did we unlearn them? And they were like, intelligence is a demand-driven enterprise. When people ask better questions, they get better answers.
I also think there's a real challenge that we see here in war zones, especially with the rotational nature of what we're doing, and that every time we rotate people through, every time tours change, we have to relearn those same lessons because we don't necessarily have a really good process for handing over lessons learned. And that makes us sort of like the movie Memento, where we're reliving the same thing over and over again.
It also, it has become this incredibly defensive issue for the Department of Defense and the U.S. government writ large, where we talk about our precision weapons that are truly precise in a lot of ways. You can see watching these videos that they reference them hitting this target, you know, on the nose. But it, the precision also relies on the intelligence, as you guys have both talked about.
Precisely the wrong house.
Right.
I mean, it's precisely wrong.
Right. It is. It is the. It is a target that we have hit exactly right. That is the wrong house that we have hit. And to your point about this being a demand-driven issue, like the, I think we have. I read the other day the highest number of pilots in the Air Force right now are MQ-1, MQ-9 pilots.
Oh, interesting.
There are
Drone pilots.
Yeah, and drone pilots. In 2011, there were something like 37 years worth of video feed that had been taken in by drones in that year alone, and that was 6 years ago and many drones ago. So like the ability to process all of this is incredibly difficult. Like we are setting ourselves up with a monumentally impossible task that even AI is going to have difficulties with. So this is going to have some kind of reckoning of how do we, if we want to do the sort of standoff light footprint warfare, how do we rationalize doing so in a humane way?
But it's also, right, we're talking about conducting air wars in areas that are not clearly demarcated as battlefields.
For sure.
Right? We're talking about them in urban areas. We're talking about trying to root out insurgents among civilian populations. And in that circumstance, the intelligence matters even more. And the more precise we get, I think the obligation or the expectation on the military to get it right is much greater, because it's not like just airdropping a gravity bomb where it's like, okay, well, it landed somewhere in the vicinity of a house. I mean, it's just so much more precise.
And not to derail us into this is still a thing, but I thought it was telling. There was a series of airstrikes in Afghanistan last week, the week before, against a bunch of counter-narcotics compounds. And I don't want to go down that whole rabbit hole because I can't believe we're doing that again. But when I was querying folks on Twitter about that, you know, why are we pursuing this line of operations again? What came up, and what came up in the statements from the command in Afghanistan, was essentially lessons learned from the Iraq and Syria campaign, that they were basically going after sources of funding and financing. I totally dispute or question, at least, the relative contribution of poppy and opium financing toward the Taliban. But the question of why we went to this now is because one of the lessons learned from the Iraq and Syria campaign was that you can cripple an insurgency by going after its finances. And so we have done so. Not only are these lessons from Iraq complex and maybe overlearned in one way and underappreciated in another, we're now going to map them back, once again, map them back onto another theater. And so it's not just an academic question of why we do these things.
But also the underlying conditions are not the same in the two countries,
no,
right? So
not
we're
at all.
Mapping, it's like, again, always fighting the last war.
But
right.
We always do this. All right, let's shift gears slightly for our last topic in White House mayhem and talk about this, actually, an issue that was not brought up by the White House, but is very much about the White House, which was a hearing on nuclear authorities that took place in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and then also came up in at the Halifax Security Forum a few days later.
There's been a lot of concern both during and after the election about the president's authority to launch a nuclear first strike. And some members of Congress had introduced legislation saying that the president couldn't authorize a nuclear or order a nuclear first strike unless he had congressional authority. And so I think there are a lot of people who are very concerned that with a hot-tempered president who likes to keep people guessing, who has a tendency to escalate, you could wind up in a nuclear first strike situation that might be very uncomfortable for the people who are being given that order. And what we saw is two former heads of Strategic Command saying that even if the president issues
one current, one former,
saying the president, even if the president issued the order, the military would do its own assessment about whether or not that order was lawful.
My question to you guys is like, is that helping? I mean, I had a gut reaction to sort of these comments. When I was watching the hearing, General Kaler like was the first to speak and within 30 seconds talked about lawful orders. And I was like, well, I know what we're going to talk about for the next 2 hours now. And that is, in fact, a lot of what the discussion then dominated. And then General Hyten, who's the current STRATCOM commander, sort of echoed that sentiment in Halifax a few days later. And I'm wondering what you guys' reaction to that was. Do you think that that help people feel better about the situation, or did it put a finer point on what's going on here?
People can make an argument about whether or not is the role of the military to assess whether or not an order is lawful. And people talked a lot on Twitter about, like, this is actually one of the things that they train you on, and this is part of our fundamental day-to-day way of doing business. I would posit that it is very different to talk about a nuclear order from the President of the United States in a potentially what he believes to be, you know, existential or high threat situation than it is to talk about like a mission that is in Afghanistan or Syria.
A Mali situation. Or...
Right. On top of that, like, this is really, it's kind of an interesting temporal question. So if we're talking about a first strike scenario, that probably is not going to be something where you are at like imminent risk, as in like in the next 5 minutes. So do you at that point have the ability to convene the National Security Council and have, for example, the Attorney General, whose real role it might be to talk about whether or not this is a lawful order, to be a part of that? They talked about this on Rational Security last week in some detail with people who, you know, are actual lawyers, which is a crazy idea.
Mika's a lawyer.
Oh, wait, sorry. I'm so sorry, Mika. You are a lawyer.
It's true. I play one on TV.
But I thought that that was interesting. So Peter Feaver made this distinction in the hearing, which was the difference between the generals waking up the president and the president waking up the generals.
Right.
And the sort of differences between this.
I think, though, and under any circumstance, it's the generals waking up the president, because it's not like the president is going to get the intelligence that says North Korea or Russia has gone to a launch alert status independently. Right. So
that I may disagree with you on based on the White House Situation Room. And this is actually going to be an interesting question on how General Kelly has set up the president's information flow. Typically, like, as somebody who's worked in the NSC before at levels around the National Security Advisor, you can get intelligence around the same time as other senior officials. I think that's a bad idea for exactly these reasons. But there are ways for them to be, if there's like something hot that comes in, you can almost certainly guarantee that, for instance, the National Security Advisor may be getting it. The question remains about whether or not the chief of staff or others close to the president would also be receiving it. That's an information flow question, not necessarily a policy question.
And I think that goes to, right, General Kelly being there as the chief of staff at the White House, right? You want someone who's going to understand their principal and understand how that flow should go. And if you have a hot-headed principal, maybe you want to be able to have your information fully digested and some options prepared before you go in to see that person, because maybe their judgment is not necessarily the best, especially with someone who has so little experience with the military. But one of the things that I think is interesting is, right, what they're saying about it has to be a lawful order, right, it contemplates this whole circumstance where you could potentially have a military officer refusing. Mm-hmm. And then what does the president do? And if the president says, I want to prosecute this person for disobeying a direct order, right, what happens then? Right now you are in this circumstance of failing, right, arguing about whether or not the order was lawful. Congress actually has authority to legislate the UCMJ, so they could actually write in an affirmative defense of, look, if you have a president who orders you to do a nuclear first strike that is not retaliatory and there is no act of Congress authorized, then that is de facto an unlawful order for which there's an affirmative defense.
It's a very interesting deterrence question then, right? I mean, we're right. Kind of angels on a pinhead in a lot of ways here.
Right.
I mean, this is the... I mean, so that...
But it puts it back on the individual.
Makes more sense in terms of a process. If we think this is a problem and we're looking for a process solution, and people would dispute both of those things. I mean, there's other people who would say that the constitutional prerogative of the executive usurps anything that the Congress could want to do here, and that they can, you know, run full steam ahead, you know, on this. I do think that all of these questions come back to the individual. Yeah, and there's long been a debate about whether people would actually follow the orders and whether things would actually go through as the, you know, standard operating procedure, right, you know, dictates.
Well, and we've seen examples of Russians who have refused to follow this order when they saw, and it turned out to be faulty signals, that they thought that the Americans were going to launch, and then they refused the order themselves. And, you know, we don't know how many times on the U.S. side there was someone in the bureaucracy who mm-hmm. heard the order come down. I mean, there were these rumors about the Nixon administration right. And saying, look, you have to have the order from both the president and from, I can't remember if it's the National Security Advisor or Secretary of Defense.
Schlesinger. That story, I think, is nearly apocryphal. The sourcing on that is not great, as it turns out.
But you know, how many times has a president called over to Stratcom and said, I need you to go? And they've said, let's just give it a minute to figure out what this really is.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brzezinski famously did yep. this, right? Doesn't wake the president, waits because he thinks it's not going to be. He's like, well, either we're all going to be dead in 30 minutes or I'm right. And so sort of, you know, waits out a false alarm.
But what I loved in that story is that he receives two telephone calls and doesn't just mm-hmm. stay on the line in this, right. which is maybe a relic of the era that it's in. And also that it's the military aid that's involved in there. And like, as somebody who has served in a similar role, I had a moment of terror thinking, please do not make me do that job.
Look, part of the problem is I think both this deterrent solution and missile defense are solutions that focus on the last 8 minutes of the problem after launch. Mm, mm-hmm. And like, there is so much that leads up to that moment, but we focus so much attention on the post-launch options instead of on what can you do before you even get to that moment.
I think that's a great point. One of the other things that the hearing members floated, I mean, they were kind of dancing around this issue, but which is basically like, if you object to any president having unilateral launch authority, then yes, you, Congress, could look at revising the launch authorities. If you object to this president having launch authority, there are a number of political remedies that don't touch on nuclear command and control, strategic stability, and deterrence that you, Congress, a political body, could pursue. And these were, you know, it's a quite esteemed, you know, sort of panel. Not a lot of folks who want to really jump in the middle of the road, you know, and get
None
run
of
over.
Them are really bomb throwers between Brian McEwen, Peter Fever, and Kaler,
you know. but they were basically like, look, don't. I mean, I think that they were basically, you know, none of you cared for the previous, you know, 10 presidents, right? We're having this conversation in this context. That suggested you guys have a political problem, not a nuclear command and control problem. And I thought that was a really interesting, I mean, it was a punt by them in some ways to get away from answering a very difficult question, but it was important, I thought, context to add to it.
But I would say, while I think this problem is thrown into sharp relief by this particular president, it is certainly a problem that is capable of repetition.
Oh, for sure.
So it may be something that, you know, and look, who knows what would have happened. What Mitch McConnell would have been saying had Hillary Clinton won this election, he might be actually pushing this back the same way and saying that you can imagine the horrific things would be being said about a woman being too emotional to have the codes, right? Like,
man, I never want to hear that argument again after this administration.
Nope.
All right.
We've actually, on that note, we've kind of forgotten to ask Mika about the reason that we brought her on the show to begin with.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to talk about public polling and public opinion?
Sure. So I'm sort of this like weird unicorn in the national security space in that I do a lot of work on...
For a number of reasons.
For a number of reasons. It's true. But I do a lot of work on public opinion around national security, which is not something that is normally asked about in all the other political polls that are asked about. So we keep an eye on publicly available polls on national security and then have run our own in the past. And one of the things that we have seen is that there's a real partisan divide in trust in the two parties on national security, that Republicans are much more trusted on national security than Democrats, and that messages are heard differently than depending on who the speaker is between Republicans and Democrats on national security issues. And so one of the things that really does is it opens and closes options that people can pursue politically as they're looking for national security things. And so this particularly affects Congress and their role in national security, because it's not just what is the right answer for the nation, but it's also what does the public think of that answer? So this is one of the real disconnects for the national security community, for those of us who spend all our time thinking about options and getting masters in international relations. Like, what the right answer might be may not be the same as an answer that Congress is going to accept because of a variety of other
And we certainly
factors.
See kind of, I don't know if I want to call it a comeback, but a resurgence of congressional influence or assertions of authority recently that we've you know, Congress had abdicated a lot of its role on national security issues, certainly since, I would say, since 9/11, maybe even, maybe that's not the right cut point, but that's my professional memory of these issues.
Yeah, it's really, it's interesting because, you know, I'm a lot older than people give me credit for, but have been working in Congress a very long time on national security issues. And for a long time through the 80s and 90s, actually, Congress played a much more influential role in national security. And you saw things like the Jackson-Vanik Amendment or most favored nation status renewals for China. You actually saw the end of the apartheid government in South Africa as a direct result of congressional action. Ron Dellums had been working on the South Africa Sanctions Act since he came to Congress in 74, and it didn't pass until the late 80s over Reagan's veto. And once that
Bolin Amendments,
the Bolin Amendments, right, which led to Iran-Contra, Congress was much more engaged in limiting the ways in which the executive could operate in national security. And one of the things that's interesting about Congress is they take a much longer view of these things and the tools that you can use. So, right, things like the Cuba embargo and, right, and some of these other pieces where they were able to help shepherd through foreign policy solutions by taking a much longer view.
Or their role in weapon systems and procurement and funding or defunding particular options, certainly through the Cold War. That was a big question.
And, or one of my favorites on this is actually Goldwater Nichols, right? Mm-hmm. To implement joint duty assignments was a solution where Congress said, okay, well, how do we get the military to actually be joint? Well, we're going to give preference to people who do joint duty assignments at a certain point, and then time will take care of this problem because people will value it because it's valued in the promotion process.
And the creation of Special Operations Command.
So Congress at one point was much more engaged in this. And then post 9/11, they gave a lot more deference to the executive. The executive kept coming into Congress asking for sort of unlimited broad authorities. And you can see that in the 9/11 authorization itself and in the way the Bush administration interpreted that. And starting in about 2006, Congress started doing more, but really in the last 18 months, Congress has gotten much more aggressive in trying to limit the executive's options on national security. You see that in the large amounts of bipartisan support for imposing additional Iran sanctions. And you see this president even punting additional national security questions like on the Iran deal to Congress.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's most interesting is you've had examples of Congress trying to claw issues back, claw authorities back, whether through the purse or, you know, other administrative actions. But you hadn't seen a lot of executive branch ceding of topics or authorities. And so that's certainly, you mentioned so if we talk about what's next, then, you know, one of the things that's coming up, we decertified the Iran deal on national security grounds, some number of days fewer than 90 ago.
Claimed national security grounds.
Well, I'm just saying that was what was in the document. And so we're due for, the Congress has a big decision to make about whether they're actually going to implement sanctions.
That's right.
The Congress has a busy calendar.
That's right.
All of our what's next things are basically like what's next for the Senate for the next 3 weeks.
Right. And reimposition of sanctions on Iran is nowhere on the Senate's calendar. We haven't heard about anyone drafting additional legislation. I think most members of Congress would not like to have to take this vote again. In particular, I think, right, as a former HPSI staffer, I think the Iran deal provides a lot of access and insight into where Iran is in its nuclear program and a lot of insight in ways we can get into inspections on the ground, more so than we had before. And shutting off this deal means all of those inspectors and all of those collection methods get thrown out of the country and we go blind. And Iran would certainly race for the bomb. So I think it's like a terrible idea from a, like if you're a security hawk, you want to make sure that they're locked down as much as possible. But so I think from Congress's perspective, it's a bad idea, though, you know, I'm sure the current director of the CIA has different views on that.
There's some other senators who also have some, you know, wearing some bad idea jeans on the Iran deal questions. Lauren, what else are you watching for what's next?
This is a little bit in the future, but just to highlight one of the many provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act, actually two of them. related to our civilian casualty discussion earlier, there was a provision inserted by Senator Warren, among others, to have the administration have to release a regular report on civilian casualties committed by the U.S. government. That is similar, I believe, in scope to what the Obama administration had put into their executive order that they released in summer of 2016. It will be interesting to see the extent to which this administration actually follows that and in what detail. Related to that the NDAA also requires that the administration do a regular report, outlining the legal and policy justification for use of force in Syria, Afghanistan, or anywhere else in the world. Again, this is similar to something that the Obama administration had done under its own authority last year in December, but had not been put into law. This is going to require this administration to explain what exactly is the justification for you doing things in, say, Niger or Afghanistan or Syria or elsewhere.
Somalia, where we've had a huge uptick in airstrikes this year.
Right. These are things that are sort of assumed and kind of batted around amongst the people who follow these issues, but are not typically discussed in a lot of detail by the U.S. government. It will be very interesting to see if they actually make these public versus just turning them in as reports to Congress. And that'll be over the next few months that we see those come in, but I'll be watching those closely.
Anything else we're watching for what's next?
What I am watching for what's next is Congress's efforts to renew certain electronic surveillance authorities under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. Which I helped write a long time ago as a staffer. But there have been these ongoing machinations on various parts of the Hill about how they will renew that or if they will renew that, which just got complicated by the stepping down of one John Conyers as ranking member on the Judiciary Committee. He was the main Democratic sponsor of the House Judiciary Bill, Section 702 reform legislation. And so now there's, and beyond that, then, the chamber has on multiple occasions voted to try and put additional constraints on the FBI when they're searching Americans' data, which seems like is a thing consistent with the Constitution. But Speaker Ryan has said that he would not allow legislation to come to the floor that would include those additional protections. For more on that, you can listen to me arguing with Jamil Jaffer about this on the Steptoe Cyber Law podcast.
Pop culture.
Oh my God, there's going to be a royal wedding.
We're very excited about wedding for no good reason.
She's an American.
She's an American. I have a fascinator I'm going to wear whenever they get married, just sitting on my couch watching them get married.
Yes, there's going to be a lot of interesting drama, I think, associated with this particular wedding, and it's going to be amazing.
She's an American. She's divorced.
She's mixed race.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Everything about, like, I just want to watch the Queen and Prince Philip just sit there and smile.
Apparently, she and Prince Harry also distantly related on her father's side.
Really?
Yes.
But I feel like we're all kind of distantly related.
Not
to
all
Harry.
Of us.
So it turns out we had two bits of Pixar news last week.
Wow.
One was the release of an Incredibles 2 trailer, and I, for one, have been waiting a very long time for an Incredibles sequel.
I just want to point out, I am the only parent in the room, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, I'm sorry. Go watch Toy Story again. The other bit of news, of course, is that John Lasseter, who's the director of almost all of the good Pixar stories, is himself caught up, has resigned from Pixar, was taking a leave of absence following sexual harassment, undisclosed sexual harassment allegations or innuendo or something. So basically nobody is free from...
Does this mean I have to give up Toy Story and everything else?
I have not. There's a Paris Review article you can read to determine whether how you feel about these questions.
Because like giving up the original Cosby comedy routines, that was tough, I have to admit.
It's also all the Woody Allen movies, right? Anything but from Miramax. It just becomes,
it's
like, what are you going to watch? Like, just Wonder Woman over and over again? But yet, Steve Nugent's a producer.
Can you just not be shits? Just not be assholes, and it would be so much easier, guys.
In other news, very interestingly today, Russell Crowe tweeted that we may get a Master and Commander sequel, which I am very excited about, potentially.
I'm sure a lot of the audience here.
Paul Bettany is still alive. Yes.
He is.
Okay, because I get him confused with this other guy who is not alive anymore.
And he is much closer to his fighting form than Russell Crowe is for those roles.
Because the image of them playing the violin and the cello together is just delightful. So cozy.
It's
and
so delightful.
Makes me want to go like sit at home and drink cider in front of a fire.
The soundtrack is excellent. Do you ladies have any pop culture news?
My only big pop culture news is that I got into a Twitter conversation with John Cusack about High Fidelity.
It was amazing.
It was amazing. I didn't realize that having a Twitter conversation with John Cusack was on my bucket list, but it was. Item checked.
Okay, how did this start?
Somebody was tweeting about how they love the movie, and like, I actually find High Fidelity a very upsetting movie because of the ways in which John Cusack's character handles one of his ex-girlfriends who was basically sexually assaulted. And I said that, and then John Cusack wrote back to me and said that he actually really likes how the movie shows that even deeply flawed people can continue to search for the truth. And I said, fair enough, but like, still really upsetting the lack of empathy of the character.
I think you won. Not only did you have a Twitter conversation with John Cusack, you won.
I went home and watched Gross Point Blank that night, I have to say, which is an amazing movie. Total Gen X movie, underappreciated in the national security community. But
and
it
if
is.
You don't have the soundtrack, you should definitely go listen to it right now.
It's outstanding. All right. Anything else, ladies? Mika, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for bringing the French 75s.
They were lovely.
We'll see everybody in a couple of weeks.